Time for our next presentation. Chris Fornell has been in media and entertainment for more than 30 years, starting in creative production as a director of photography, producer, and director. Okay. Then he joined public media, where he shared his knowledge of production and post-production complexities. At WGBH Boston, Chris managed post-production for some of PBS's most prestigious programs, including Frontline, Nova, American Experience, and Ken Burns series. Chris wrote a magazine article about prudent file-based workflow entitled Scared Straight. Chris later joined Signiant, where he leads the team that produces content for Signiant's global audience. In his free time, Chris enjoys cooking and camping and digitizing his grandparents' 8mm film. His teams are Tottenham Hotspur's soccer team and the Minnesota Vikings. Tough crowd. And Chris's top two favorite places to travel are Voyager National Park in Minnesota and the Middle East. His motto is Ordo ad Chaos, order from chaos. Here's Chris Fornell with Snowflakes, Tear Gas, and Kool-Aid, lessons learned from public media, dark edit suites, and SaaS cubicles.
Thank you. It's right and just that you boo the Vikings right now. I don't blame you. I'm very honored to speak with you. This is my first time here, and I connected with Vicky earlier this year and was honored to be asked to speak here. And when I was looking to put together a presentation, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to say to a room full of engineers. Most of my career, there's nothing I could ever say that the engineers didn't already know. And so I realized that the best topic I could give today is to really pick the one I know the best, and that's me. So I'm going to tell you some stories from the last about 20 years of my life that have been influential on me, has caused me to change the way I think about my role in media and entertainment, how I work with other people, and what I'm trying to leave behind at every place I'm at. So a little context. I've been in the business since the mid-90s. I started off at the bottom as a grip, have done lighting, camera, director of photography, and everything in between. And in around 2002, I got into more post-production and post-production management. But all through the course of my life, I would say I bridge the gap between the technical and the creative. I like talking about color space and 2110 and metadata, and I also like talking about editing platforms and what will make the content better and story structure. So I feel I've been in a unique place to be in both worlds. Never good enough to be an engineer, never good enough to be a producer of a big show, but dangerous enough in the middle where I can speak to both and hopefully help along. So the time period I'm going to talk about, it's 20 years. It looks long, but really it's about three or four stories. And the first story I'm going to talk about is when I came to Frontline. I had been, like I had heard from someone else today, been in the business for a while. I had shot film. I'd done some commercials, worked on a couple motion pictures, thought I knew it all. And then I get to Frontline in Boston, and it was graduate school. It was like trying to get your PhD. It was like nothing I'd ever heard. And the reason I called this the section about snowflakes, now snowflakes right now have a negative connotations toward it. But in my world of media and entertainment, it also means somebody that is so special that whatever they ask a vendor for, they want to make it special for them, that their work is like no one else's. They are special at what they do, the content they put out, and that was kind of me at that time. So as Vicky said, my first part in public media was with Frontline, the documentary series program. which is produced out of WGBH in Boston for PBS. On an average show, average season, they would produce between 15 to 20 episodes, as much as 50 hours of content in a season. And on the side of that, they're also making their own promos, they're making excerpts, they're doing special versions. So 20 to 25 episodes a season doesn't sound like much, but over the course of the year, it's constant work. There's always things that are coming in or going out. I made this timeline in 2017, so it might be a little out of date now because I've been away from it for a while. But this is a timeline from the very left, where a film gets commissioned, to the very right, when all the deliverables, everything's done, the finances are done and put to bed. I work in that tall area of a week, that's online week, where the show finishes, it comes to us, we have to get a bunch of stuff done and get it out. Now, the show never comes to us clean, ready, hey, it's all done, do your week and move on. It comes to us in pieces and parts, still editing, lots of changes, and so that week is really compressed. Now, when you do show after show after show in a week, you can see the stacking problem that we had. So I was with a group that worked in this. It was called the Outpost. Outpost was a separate group that Frontline owned, or was part of Frontline, loosely connected to WGBH, but was separate from WGBH's own post-production group. And so it was a small group of men and women who were doing all that work. It's a national show, but don't make the mistake of thinking that it's endless money there. It's not. It's very, very lean and mean and scrappy. But we had really smart people and dedicated people to get all that work done. The team consists of about two editors, online editors. One was online in color, one was a promo editor, and we had a post-production assistant, we had me, and a coordinating producer. This team has grown as platform streaming demands have grown, as more work is needed, as we've had to be more remote. This team is probably a little bit double that now, with a lot of freelance work that comes in. But the core of the group is still there. So the frontline team, when I got there, it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. They were they valued the journalism and getting the story correct above almost everything else. They would go through great measures to get that story done. Shows would get opened up at the last minute, lines would get re-narrated, new footage would come in. It was being cut editorially, literally to the last minute. The Outpost had a kind of a different mission. Its mission was about high quality, saying yes at all times. We're in the service industry, most of us here, right? We're serving something. Our job is to say yes. There were times where it's saying yes, but my manager, Tim Mangini, instilled in us this mission, this idea that we can keep doing more. You need to recolor the whole show in an hour? Yes, we can do that. You need to redo 200 subtitles because it's the wrong font? Yes, we'll do that. So he had a mission around what was expected and how much it would take to get there. He changed the definition of time for us, how much we could do with time. On the editorial side, because of their high sense of journalism for news, for fact, for objective reporting, their mission sometimes was at the odds of our mission, where they want as much time as possible, we need to get the show done. And I will admit, as the one trying to coordinate all that, it gets frustrating. Why can't the producers come in and get their show done on time? Why can't the next producers get their show done on time? But there are times when you're sitting in the edit suite late at night, and you get to hear the executive producer and founder, David Fanning, or the current one, Rainey Aronson-Rath, talk to you about how important it is, what this show means for a public policy, what it means for this family in Afghanistan, and what this means for poor kids in the South. Their mission raised us up to be better than we were before. Their mission inspired us to go through and do all that hard work and do all that. Sign me up for 2 more years. I'm worth it with you after you heard them talk. And so my first lesson, or really a reminder, because we all have mission statements and we all have missions. I've heard it today. Chris Tart talked about it. The last group had a similar theme. I believe mission is incredibly important. At the beginning of my career, it's just kind of lip service. But as I get older and older, and as I manage more myself, as I have younger people coming underneath me, I realize how powerful mission can be. It can inspire you to do great, great things. It can inspire your staff to do great, great things. And I think Chris was talking about him as an example of doing all the little things, and that would rub off onto the next group and the next group. Setting a mission, not just for a company, not just for a department, even for you, of what are you all about? So I'm a big believer in establishing missions officially and unofficially, and then trying to live to them. Expect excellence. That should be no surprise to anyone here, right? All engineers, excellence is what we do. That is not everywhere around us. And with pressures put on us to make more content, to make it faster, to do more things, excellence gets a knock off in the times. And what I've learned, though, is we have to keep shooting for that excellence every time. We can always compromise because of situation or budget or something like that. We do. But we need to go back to for everything we do, we need to go back to it as that's the top. We can always go down, but if you start lower, you're just going to keep going down lower. If you start at the top, maybe you won't go down quite as far. The team around you matters. The team around you matters also if they have buy-in in the mission. If they don't have buy-in in the mission, that really breaks things down. I had an employee one time. He had been there for 40 years. This is kind of later in my story here, where when we took over his area, wanted to help him along, wanted to get him on board with how we do things, setting him up with this mission, and he really couldn't do it. And it brought the team down. We couldn't get the work done, to the quality we want. And so we had to kind of make a change on to keep that team intact. And so buy-in from the team, buy-in from your mission is an important aspect of this. Now, snowflakes can be good. I am a proud former snowflake. I will say former because I've changed a bit. I think in every group, especially media entertainment, especially what we do, we need a snowflake, we need a diva, we need a realist, right? I think we're better in that diversity we're talking about of having different types of personalities. Some people to keep us grounded, some people to keep pushing us. And all the best places I have people like that. They're unusual sometimes, or frustrating many times. But I'd rather have them because I think the work is better and more interesting. Now, this is where it gets a little bit more fun. What you learned from tear gas was a literal thing that happened to me. In about 2013, I was asked to go to Cairo a year after the Arab Spring. It had settled down, there was a new president, but the president had just been arrested by the military. And so we went there to do a story for 3 weeks to see what was happening. And I went along for a couple reasons. One is because we needed to do fast turnaround excerpts back to PBS NewsHour. And at the time, it wasn't high-speed internet. We didn't have a huge infrastructure that we can put in our hotel. And we were testing out some new ways of doing this remote send, but also remote editing. We tested from there. So I went there to work on that. So for the first week or so, the team went around. We did normal kind of interviews. Some places were very interesting. Some places we're not quite sure how we feel about being there. But one night, we were having dinner, and all of a sudden we get a report that there are police and protesters going after each other on a bridge. We stopped our meal, got up, went to our trucks and drove there. And indeed, there was a skirmish happening. I won't say battle, but rocks and tear gas were flying back and forth. To the point so bad that I had to go back and get gas masks because we had forgotten ours. We sent a small crew up. They got the footage. No one really got hurt too bad. Came back into my hotel room, which was kind of the centralized place for our equipment. And as they're sitting there, the smell of tear gas and cigarettes was in the air. And that really struck me. And it came to a realization, watching these people this is the first time I've been out in the field with them, made me think about something different. Now, as I said, this was my world. Schedule, getting the show in, moving things around, right? That was my world and what I I paid attention to of when are things coming in, how fast can I ingest them, how fast can we get ready for a screening. My schedule was dominating my focus, right? But it wasn't until I got to be with the producers in the field and see the dangers and risks that they went through that changed my mind about, I had to change my snowflake attitude. I couldn't let my technical hubris get in the way of creative content. I had to be more open of my little world of perfection that we established and we're proud of, couldn't stop content from happening. I had to remind myself content is king, not my production schedule. And that it's not all about me. That hubris of looking at only my small area of the food chain and not what the real people are doing who are making the content. Content is still king. And experiencing the other side. I'm a great believer in trying different roles and being out with different people because I learn so much about what decisions they have to go through. That's like sitting with a person who's doing a budget and you're asking them, why can't they have all this money? And the person has to show you where all the money is going. Once you understand, you're a little bit more sympathetic. I'm a little bit more sympathetic to producers out in the field now because they put it all on the line and often are in great danger. In 2014-ish, my boss, Tim Mangini, and I were asked to take over WGBH's post-production. So the Outpost was kind of an offshoot of this. We were asked to take over all of it because of our reputation within the building. And this has caused a lot of thinking on how do we do this? How do we go from bespoke to enterprise? Can we take the things that we thought were valuable and how we thought things should be done and put it to a larger group? Is that possible? And we found out a couple of things quite quickly is I was building workflows and procedures and processes for the people and the work I knew. So one of the first lessons is that I had to open myself up and talk to a lot of people and what they do so then I can put a schedule and an equipment list and together. I couldn't implant everything that I did onto them and expect it to work. They had different people of different skill sets and different deadlines and different missions. So that was quite eye-opening to me. The other thing was my mission of what could be didn't have to go away, but the values could. So I had to change my mission for this new group to operate at scale, to be a bit more standardized across all my systems, to not have so many bespoke, crappy things I got off the internet. I had to be thinking about security now. And when you're responsible for doing that, when it's your time to, and responsible, you look at things very, very different than when you were just a worker bee and could get away with that. So special, bespoke, snowflake is very hard to do at scale. It's much easier to do it when it's just your little group. But you try to put that across 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 shows, it doesn't scale very well. And so I had to learn that while as valuable as that old way is, the new way at Enterprise, I had to be more socialist. I had to be more centralized and standardized and put things in so it couldn't be the wild, wild west of post-production anymore. I had to think bigger, meaning I couldn't put in a workflow that fixed one thing. I had to think bigger and what more can this do? What can't this do? That was my big, I really enjoyed talking to vendors a lot, asking what the product could do, but more important, what the product couldn't do, because I want to know if other things came up, could it help me or would it hurt me? And so I had to kind of push myself to think of more about my arena and what tool sets I had in it. Responsibility definitely changed my process, but not my values. I touched on that before of now that I'm responsible, I had to be much more buttoned up. I had to be much more documented and focused and evaluating more tools to see if it works for everybody before implementing them. I had to get all of our hardware updated and standardized. And so my whole process of mission and how we do it changed slightly, but not the reasons why we should do it. And content is still king. We are still doing that for content. That it has not changed. I wouldn't expect it to change at public media. So now I'm at Signiant. And for those that don't know Signiant is a cloud-based, multi-tenant content exchange platform. If you still don't know what that is, think of Aspera and Massive and Dropbox. And we operate at an enterprise level of the Disneys and the NFLs all the way down to small post-production boutique places. And in my where I am now, I'm head of content production and marketing production. And I was really worried when I went to this place. It was time for me to leave. It was a good thing. But I was worried because it was still in media entertainment, it was definitely different than where I came from. And what kind of place would I have in that? They're going from a public media centric to business centric. Content was not the main asset that they were producing, and I was by myself, so there wasn't really a team yet to build around. But over the years, we have expanded that, and we're now able to slowly but surely add new services around media production there, around content, around graphics, to expand their content. And it's not just video content, which is relatively new, it's print content. We probably have 50 to 70 different projects going on at any given time. And my job is very much like it was before. I'm bringing the planes in like an air traffic controller and getting them out. Touch on that. So when I think back now to my time at Frontline and what I learned there, and my time at as the heading up enterprise at WGBH, what things can I take, and what things have I learned that I can apply to this new place? So on reflection, I've come to the idea that mission is not just company made, that the department has a responsibility, and the person has a responsibility, and I have a responsibility. So if I want my group to have to do more and be more and train them more and mentor them more, then that's on me to do. I can't wait for the company to do that. I need to set the values for the team. Good enough is not good enough. We're going to go the extra step. We don't have to stay late every night, but if the job's not done, we have to do it. I'm working now with people in marketing who are not from the media industry, right? So they haven't gone through, been on crews and on TV stations and done this work, coming from an entirely different way. So I'm trying to map what I've learned from media entertainment, from working with you all, onto them. And in my fear that I wasn't going to be bringing as much into this new role, that's been a leave now. Now I have come, no matter what job I have going on, I know I can take these things that I've learned and use them. They're agnostic. I can go any place with a lot of these things. And it's who I am. Like, I can't change that. So just because I change industries doesn't mean I can change that belief system. And while Signian is not a content maker and their content deliverer, I still believe in my small role now at Signian, that content eventually will be king, and that we'll still make that the focus, because that helps marketing, that helps our image. The more we can do good content, the more we'll be respected. And so I do still think content is king. And I thank you. Now, I don't like asking questions in a crowd, so if you have any, certainly now is fine, but also I will be around. So I'm happy to talk more on any of the subject, or just what Signiant does, or past experiences. Post-production, I'm very fluent in.
Hi, Chris. I have a question. We work with a national caption vendor with a really good reputation. And this particular vendor has us use Signiant to upload content to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why they have that extra step, or they insist on we use Signiant instead of just FTP.
Surprisingly, we replaced a lot of FTP. There is a ton out there yet that are still being used. Some of the reasons revolve around security. Some of it revolve around that they don't want the content. They want the content in their space and not somebody else's space. Signia is storage agnostic. We don't sell storage. We're using your storage. And so if somebody's bringing a file, I'm guessing it's a video file that they're sending you, right? It's not going to go through a Dropbox storage or an IBM storage. They want to secure that. The second thing we hear a lot about under that circumstance is if the file drops in the middle of the night, it'll pick itself back up. I spent a lot of time, a lot of hours, 3 a.m., waiting for those FTP uploads to happen. You know, we're doing 100 gigs to PBS or something like that. One of my big selling points that I think I brought to Signian's argument on that is you get to send people home and not pay that overtime. So that's what I'm guessing is that. Plus, there's an audit trail, right? You can tell that they've opened it. You can tell that who's touched it, and it will send notifications when it's done. And it's your IT group doesn't have to manage that as much. Anybody else? I wasn't expecting a Signia question. All right, I'm here too. Thank you very much.